It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
When voters go to the polls in Wicomico County next Tuesday, they will also be facing charter amendments that reflect an ongoing struggle within county government. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Wicomico County Executive Bob Culver is halfway through his four-year term after an upset victory against the first man to occupy the position, Rick Pollitt. But despite the dominance of Republicans on the county council, Culver finds himself at odds with his conservative colleagues. In fact, the county now has two attorneys, and there's a struggle over who will set personnel policy. In addition, voters in Wicomico County will decide another issue, whether to have an elected school board or continue with the current appointed system. Well, there's another alternative, which is a hybrid of the two. Sort out the conflict that has erupted in the county government. We have in studio Greg Bassett. He's the editor and general manager of the Salisbury Independent, a weekly publication. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Don.
Well, before we get into all the little individual amendments that will show up on the ballot, address this issue about what appears to be a power struggle going on. And this seems to be reached back even further than the set of charter amendments we have. I mean, from the get-go, there was conflict between the county executive and the county council over schools, the revamping of one of the schools, where some school stuff was supposed to be. I mean, what's going on between the county council on the one hand and the county executive on the other hand? Because as I indicated, they all seem to be conservative Republicans.
Right. They're all on the same team. I mean, there's only one Democrat on, you know, that's part of the county council. And as we've seen with Republicans for years, there's all kinds of extremities within the political party. But in this case, it's certainly one of those things where the legislative branch wants to increase its ability to perform functions. And they don't want to have to rely on the county executive for things. So what I see is they're out in the public. People ask them questions about things, and they don't like going, well, that's the county executive's problem. We don't know what he's up to. They want to take control of these issues themselves, so they've got some say, and let the two parts of government sort of, you know, contest with each other. So the different branches, executive versus legislature, is more important than party, if that makes sense.
Well, because as I remember with under Rick Pollitt, for example, we didn't see this kind of a conflict. I mean, I think at one point, I think I saw a quote by Culver who said that these charter amendments are aimed at him, almost as if it were personal. Is there just a different philosophy in terms of where Culver wants to take the county as opposed to where the council is? Or is it just simply the council is surprised at some decisions that are made by the county executive? And so now they're asserting more of their powers than perhaps they might have, say, if they, for instance, had gotten along with them.
Right. What I see is an evolution of relationships. So if you go back when Rick Pollitt was the county executive and you had a Republican county council, they were at odds from day one. That, you know, they were enemies. And they staked everything out as enemies, as political enemies. When you started this administration, the very first meeting at the Chamber of Commerce that I was at, I'll never forget it, Bob was treating the council as sort of his cabinet, you know, and he's going to have each council member who had an expertise in something give him advice on how to conduct things. So as an example, Matt Holloway is very connected to the farming community, so that Matt Holloway would be Bob's consultant, his advisor on farming matters. Well, the cabinet fell apart very fast because the branches of government are different. So what you have is people who are friends and allies all of a sudden sorting out their definitions of who they are as politicians and their own constituencies and the phone calls that they receive. And it causes even more tensions, and it's much more personal than it would be under the Pollitt situation.
Do you think that this is just simply that Culver came into his job with a particular vision of what this job was supposed to be, and that maybe, I don't know, there's a lack of familiarity or what it is that no, this is not how it works, that these are two co-equals?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think Bob had some ideas about how things should change, and they were certainly outside the box. He was thinking outside the box on some things. The council may be more inside the box on topics, and certainly some of the things he ran on in the campaign he wanted to implement. So, you know, you mentioned the county attorney. The county attorney situation, I think, is at the heart of this whole problem, how he conducted himself early on. Now, what he did is when he was running for election, he saw the Department of Law as this giant waste of money for the county. And he was probably right to a big degree. The thing had grown, but it was probably more than the county needed. There was just a lot of people in there. There was a lot of money spent on legal help. So he wanted to change that. Now, when he said that he wanted to abolish the Department of Law, which is, you know, probably a violation of the charter, hire an attorney on a retainer type system to save money. That was his Republican values trying to save money. The council was like, wait a minute, this is a violation of the charter. The charter exists for a reason. This is what it's supposed to be. And the way he sort of did it on his own really, really torqued them. They're still mad about that. They weren't able to approve his county attorney. And then they went out, they got their own county attorney. The whole thing has devolved into a big mess. But it shows that Bob, and you know, and I thought when Bob did this, he would probably hire one of his buddies to be the county attorney, that it would be like sort of a political payback kind of thing. Because you see that in politics. But he didn't really have anyone in mind to be the county attorney. And he hired a guy who's completely, totally competent and probably a Democrat. I'm not sure, but he's not one of the right wingers in town, one of the right wing attorneys. And this is in Paul Wilbur, the former city. He's a former lawyer for the city of Salisbury. So it's sort of fascinating thing. He was sticking to what he wanted to do in terms of saving money, but the council wasn't on board, and they have subtly fought him on this. And you see in these charter amendments some things that reflect back on the county attorney, so that future county executives can't do something like this.
Before I get to the individual ones, is this, do you think, and this has struck me when I first watched Culver and the initial conflicts, is that Culver comes in with we've got to cut spending, we have to cut spending, which is a very traditional mantra. And he did it with, he certainly was suggesting it with the Salisbury School out on the west side.
Right.
He suggests the same thing when they were talking about some school buildings. That seemed to be the guiding light, and you had these Republicans who are sitting in the council. Either that's not easy, that's not their top priority, or that they say no, there's something more, and it's more complicated than that.
Yeah, he tried to bring some common sense approaches to some things. So I mean, the education system in the state of Maryland has so many rules about what has to happen in what order, you know, by what time, yeah. And he wanted to cut through all that and try to save some money. And he was rebuffed on a lot of those things. Now, he succeeded to a degree that he raised the issue with West Salisbury School to a point that they're going to spend $10 or $15 million less than they probably would have. Well, in a $28 million school, is that a lot of money? You know, $10 million is still a lot of money. But so he focused the debate. He didn't get what he wanted, but he focused the debate. Same thing with the Bennett Fields. He wanted to change that program. Those things were kind of far down in the pipeline, so it was hard to go back on that. And, of course, then you had parents calling their council members, screaming, what's the county executive trying to do? And then you've got council members who are going to respond to that. So that created an awkward situation. But he did, and he has brought a common sense approach to stuff. You know, no more take-home cars and cutting back on the amount of gasoline that, you know, the county employees use. Some of the things in his own behavior that's different than what Rick Pollitt did in terms of everyone having a county access to things with P cards and everything else. So he's done that. He's brought some common sense things in, and that's the way he is. That's what he believes.
To turn to some of the charter amendments and sort of almost in groups. So we have this charter amendment that says it wants personnel changes. What does it basically say, and how would that impact county government if it were approved?
Yeah, again, that's another thing that's come out. Now, well, you've got the charter members. There's nine on the ballot. Mm-hmm. Five are new that have never been through a charter review committee. The way it works is every 10 years, a committee of citizens sit down, they review the charter, and they decide what needs to be changed. So five of the things on here have not gone through a charter review committee. Four of the things have been and have been approved by the Charter Review Committee when I think it last met in 2012 or 2014. So the reason that those amendments didn't get on the ballot before was because they didn't want to pollute the ballot with too many measures that might confuse people. So now you have a situation where things have backed up. They have five of their own that they want, new ones. They've got four old ones, so there's nine on there. It's going to be a very cumbersome ballot to wade through. But this personnel thing is the county changed the vendor that it uses for its county health insurance. It made some adjustments, and some county employees had some differences in their copays and things like that. When they went to the doctor, maybe they paid $7 and they were having to pay $21, and they were upset. You know, this is not what we bargained for. This is not what we were promised. So they went to the county executive. County executive basically said, that's life. Things change. Healthcare is hard. You know, it's going up $40 million. So, you know, just everyone has to buck up. That was sort of the response. It's not what they wanted to hear. So they go to their council members and they start coming to the council meetings and complaining about the changes in the county health plan. County council members were like, wow, we don't have any say in this. There's nothing we can do. Again, they're in a situation, they're like, well, the county executive has to figure this out. We're sorry. So they've taken steps to make sure that they're involved in this situation. Now, if it's you or me, I don't want to have to make those decisions if I'm on the county council. Let the administrator make that. But they want involvement in that. They want sign off on this. They want to be able to vote on it and approve what the county executive does in terms of this issue with the health care. So it expands to everything else with personnel. So they're going to have a personnel say. Now, they already do. They're supposed to be able to vote on changes to the employee handbook and things like that. But how many of those things actually end up before the council? I'm not sure. And how interested they are in all those things, you know, I'm not sure. But at the same time, this, in the county executive's mind, he should be able to run the county government and the employees that report to him the way that he wants. He shouldn't have to go and ask the council for permission on everything.
Also, turn to the Department of Reorganization, sort of dovetails into this. Again, what does that amendment do, and how, from where does it grow?
Right. So this is an example of, this is the lawyer situation again. So the reorganization is, you just can't reorganize the government without getting the county council's approval. So imagine, you know, we have a situation in our county that's unique where parks, recreation, and tourism are all one department. So imagine you wanted to combine public works with that. The county executive probably could go in there and make the public works director also the director of those other two departments, combine the departments. But what they're saying here is you can't reorganize without their approval. You can't pull, not a scheme, but you can't do something like you've done with this attorney situation where you just abolish a department and hire an outsider without us being able to weigh in on who that outsider is.
And also then we have budget reviews. From what I'm reading, some people say it's a big deal. Other people say it's already happening.
It's already happening. I mean, so what the county council says in this situation is that they're trying to codify practices that have already been in existence for 10 years. Now, the way it works is you have an example. So the council can only cut the county executive's budget. So he'll present the budget. They can make cuts. And every year they do make cuts. So what they did, as an example, this last cycle, at the very end of the budget, Joe Holloway, who represents Eastern Wicomico County, a lot of rural roads, they were able to cut spending in one department. And Joe helped lead the cut in that spending. And he wanted that money to go to improving roads in that part of the county. So he was able to negotiate with the county executive to take money out of one account. He supported something else of the county executive. It was political. That's what politics do. They negotiate these things at the end. And that money goes, anything that's cut goes into a fund. Well, that's always been done that way. And it's always worked successfully, even under Rick Pollitt. But the council now wants to codify that so that it can't be snuck off into some other account, that it's all written down somewhere. They like the idea, I think, of having rules written down so whenever a county executive tries to do something, they'll be able to go, that's not in the county charter. They always want to be able to refer back to the county charter and not have any vagueness in terms of how the county executive is conducting himself or themselves either. They'll always know what the rules are. But, you know, the county executive's like, this is ridiculous. You know, we need to be able to negotiate at the end. The county administrator is like, this is a completely unneeded thing. The county council admits that the system's working fine, but they just want to codify how it should go.
Before we get to the school board, we also have charter amendments that obviously have been hanging around for a long time. Any controversy about those?
There's a few things. No. Bob Culver has sort of picked on the there's succession decisions. So
right.
If Bob were to step down for a while, under the current charter, he could appoint you or me to be the county executive in his absence. The county council doesn't like that. And that's actually from the charter review committee from before. So it would have to be the director of administration could be. And of course, then the county council could sign off on that. And there's some arguments about whether you're appointed for the remainder of the term or you have to stand election, the next available election. There's some back and forth about that. What the county council's done with these changes is you do have to stand election if there's an election in between a presidential election year in between the appointment time. If not, you wait till the next election. So there's some back and forth about that, but it's kind of minor stuff. That really is true housekeeping things. It's not as progressive as these other things.
Hmm. Turning to the school board, as I indicated, we've got sort of three selections. One is to have an elected school board, another one to keep the appointed system, and another one actually to have some kind of hybrid. What's the background behind this? Why is it that we've suddenly, it's not suddenly, isn't it, the last few years, but suddenly decided that, well, maybe this is something that we need to do?
Right. What I see is, I mean, there's, again, like with all these things, there's five or six things that come together that make things happen. One is a 20-year history of school spending that people just don't seem to understand. So, you know, they don't understand why a new Bennett High School costs $56 million. They can't comprehend something like that. So the conversation in their homes is the school board is out of control. They don't know what they're doing. They're gold plating these things. They're wasting our money. We need accountability. We can't do anything about the school board because they're appointed. The other thing is you've had the changes in governors, but you've always had a Democratic governor. So the governor appoints the school board, and whoever's the governor gets the majority. So if there's five members of the school board, three are going to be Democrats, two are going to be Republicans. And that makes people mad because it's a Republican county. They think they should have a Republican majority. So there's that fight that goes on. Also, you know, 20 years ago, most school boards in the state of Maryland were appointed. You saw here in Worcester County 10 years ago, they went to the same sort of thing because of infrastructure spending. They went to a elected school board, and we've all witnessed that. There really haven't been many changes. It hasn't really affected anything that I can see in Worcester County, but there is an accountability situation there. So there are a lot of people who want not necessarily control the school board, but they want say in what goes on in the school board. So they want to make it an elected body. But how to do that and guarantee diversity and guarantee the quality candidates and all that is the issue. So that's why you have, again, kind of a cumbersome situation where you get to pick from three things right on this ballot. And just as an aside, what amazes me is, you know, for the last 15 years, I've heard nothing but we need a referendum on an elected school board, and people mostly from the right. And the idea is now finally you've got this referendum that you've dreamed of forever, but you've clouded the whole ballot by adding all these charter amendments that distract from your key issue. So if you want to motivate people to go out and vote for an elected school board, that's what you should be putting all your political capital in. And now you've also got these other nine things that I think just confuse people. And they're not sure what's going on. There's so much in there that they might look and see all these things they have to choose from and go, I'm going to vote for president. That's it. I can't deal with this other stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and nothing
exactly
against the voters, but people.
It was a long ballot.
It's
a
long,
looking at it.
It's
yeah,
a long ballot. So that kind of it surprises me that as much as they wanted the selected school board, they would let these other issues kind of intrude on the primary objective, and that's to get an elected school board.
Let me just get, maybe it's a naive question, but why should it be that when we have a school board, whether it's elected or not, but that party affiliation is so important? Why?
Well, you're going to run for the school board as non-declared. So there won't be
just nonpartisan,
right? It'll be a nonpartisan
theoretically,
election.
Yeah.
But I guess we'll know who's who and stuff like that. Now in Worcester County, it's nonpartisan, and you see the signs down there. In the one part of the Worcester County that I'm in all the time, there's a school board candidate, and there's a Clinton sign next to her sign, and the other guy, Fran Gebhardt, there's a Trump sign next to his. So I guess that's how they've been able to help you understand who's Republican and who's a Democrat. But on the ballot, it doesn't say. And the same thing would happen here. It would not be a partisan ballot.
So is there you've said you've looked at the Worcester County thing, and
yeah,
it seems to be going along without a lot of conflict. But one of the questions that always raised for me as I looked outside to some school boards are social issues. Which often get caught up in elected school boards, and you hear about school boards making certain decisions about, for instance, textbooks, which is one of the things that this school board certainly oversees. And then suddenly you get this big brouhaha, and you're embroiled in these things. Do you think there's any kind of danger to that? Or, I mean, how do you read the county in this area? Because in other areas, in other counties, this has been the case. doesn't sound like it's been the case in Worcester.
My experience watching school boards is that they're all very earnest people who care a lot about kids, which, you know, which is really mm-hmm. important. But there's so many rules about how many personnel you have for different departments and what you need to spend on certain needs and where you could go with curriculums that they're kind of limited in what they can do. And you also see that they have sort of a common sense approach where they think they know a lot, and they get in there and these administrators start explaining to them what the real deal is. And then they're like, wow, okay, we didn't know that. We thought it was simpler than that. So they're not able to act as much on things as they would really like. But certainly they make the personnel decisions. So the school board definitely hired our latest superintendent. So there's right. a lot, there's flexibility and things like that with personnel and certainly with tone and how they would lobby the county council who writes the final check for the local appropriation. So if you've got a school board that wants to spend more money, then that certainly might influence the county council as opposed to a school board who says, we're spending plenty of money. We don't need to spend more money. There's discipline issues that they look at. Right now in Wicomico, there's a concern that minority students are disciplined, over-disciplined more than the non-minority students. There's a Justice Department review of that going on. That's a secret. I'm not able to report it because they won't tell me anything because it's all right. a secret yeah, right now. Sure. But we know that this is going on. We know it's being looked at. So those are things that the school board kind of reviews and monitors, and it's good to have that sounding board. But there's so many rules about what you can do with the schools because no one wants a really politicized system. You don't want to elect a bunch of people to the school board who all believe and who don't believe in evolution and then change your curriculum so you don't teach evolution. So there's lots of controls on what school boards can do.
By the way, how do you get diversity if you have a set of elected school board members, and they all come from, they're going to be elected by district, right?
Right.
So how do you figure, because when I look, for instance, at the county council, okay, I see the guy, he's from the African-American, right?
That's,
and then there's
from the minority right. district.
Yeah.
Right. So the way this would work, there's three options. One is to keep having an appointed school board, the system that we already have. The second option is to have an elected school board that would reflect the county council, which is there's 7 members of the county council, 5 in districts, 2 at large. In theory, that would allow 1 minority representative in District 1, which is the minority-majority right. district. But that hasn't always been the case. You know, white people have won election in that district before. So, well, they have on a state level, but still, it's not initially a protection for diversity. And then the third option would be to have 5 districts and have 2 people, rather than elected at large, appointed by a committee. And the committee would have would be thinking about making sure to retain that diversity, make sure there's a female representative or you know, African-American or Hispanic representative. So there'd be, I think, like 14 people on this committee that would review this. And I guess the county council with the approval of the county executive with the approval of the county council would appoint the committee. So this is the hybrid. It's still all very local, but it's a hybrid model. And that might ensure the diversity because, you know, the majority of students in the public school system are minority students right now. When you add the you know Asians and Hispanics as well, so there needs to be, you know, the school board's got to reflect those kids. One of the things that upsets me about the school board right now, we don't have a school board member who has a kid in the schools, you know, and that seems weird to me. If I was on that committee, you know, if it was a mixed thing, I would want a parent, you know, to be on the school board because I just think, I think you need that. I don't know why, but I just think you need a parent, someone who's really got a stake in what goes on in the schools to be a part of the decision-making process.
By the way, is any of the county council or the county executive express any sense about what they would like?
They all seem to want totally elected school board. Mm-hmm. I think one person, Mr. Hall, Councilman Hall, he says it's all a silly thing because when you look at all the research on this, nothing changes in terms of elected versus appointed. The system stays the same. There's not a lot of craziness out there. It just sort of makes people feel better. But at the same time, the county council really does want that accountability because that's what they're hearing. You know, Mark Kilmer, who's on the county council, wanted to be a school board member and couldn't get appointed. And he was so angry at the system, the appointment system, that he went out and started, you know, really rallied the elected school board situation. And through that, built political capital and got elected to county council instead. Right. When all he really set out to do was get elected to the school board at first. So they do get this from the public all the time. People want an elected school board.
We've been speaking with Greg Bassett. He's the editor and general manager of Salisbury Independent, a weekly publication. And we've been talking about the numerous, actually, charter amendments right. that certainly faced the both of us when we went to vote, along with, of course, obviously, the school board issue, which will be sort of interesting to see how it all works out. Appreciate you stopping by. This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Be sure to join us this Friday at 8 for Vintage Country with me, Tom Pittman. We're going to be saluting the legacy of the late songwriter Curly Putman, who died this week. And we're going to be featuring the top 10 for this week's date in 1963. That's Vintage Country here on WSDL.
There are around 3,000 drug courts in the United States, and they symbolize a dramatic shift away from the traditional law enforcement-centered war on drugs. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The issue of opioid addiction has picked up speed over the last few years, with states like Maine struggling even to get a handle on the problem. And there are groups around Delmarva which have enlisted the help of relatives to combat the rise of addiction. But the country has begun to turn toward drug courts that were first established in Florida in 1989. And places like Calvert and Anne Arundel counties have been celebrating their own success. To take a look at what's being done here in Wicomico County, we have in our studio Kathleen Beckstead. She is an associate judge for the County Circuit Court. And welcome to the program.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So describe for people, if they don't know, what is a drug court? What's the concept behind that?
The concept is that it is a specialized docket where we invite offenders who are in court because of their addiction to focus on treatment. And we prioritize treatment over maybe other areas of their life until such time as they are capable of handling all of life's other challenges. So that's how we begin.
And how does this differ then from ordinary courts?
It's very different because it's very collaborative. And so the judge works one-on-one with each case, the treatment provider, law enforcement, state's attorney, the public defender, to see what person needs to succeed in recovery so that they don't relapse and reoffend.
So what kinds of issues then, when you're looking at this, do you consider? I mean, what's particularly just to get into a drug court?
Mm-hmm. Well, first, we make sure that they're safe to be in drug court. And so there's a legal screen to prevent violent offenders or sexual offenders from participating. They are excluded by federal law. And after the legal screen, they are clinically screened to make sure that they're appropriate. So we screen out people who are dealers for profit. We screen out people whose needs are too great or whose primary diagnosis is not addictions problems.
So now, and there's clearly a difference, at least I'm reading some of the literature, between treatment and these courts. I mean, I understand, I was looking at, for instance, if you just simply refer to treatment, you get something like a very high dropout rate, sometimes as much as 90%, I guess, at the end of 12 months. What makes this, do you think, work as opposed to just simply treatment?
It's the level of judicial oversight. So a person in drug court is going to be returning to court a minimum of twice monthly, and they're going to account to me if they fail to go to treatment. And since that's our priority, it's going to really result in a sanction. And the idea is that you are immediately reminded why you're in drug court, and that may take the form of an essay or a reflection, possibly additional GPS monitoring, additional testing, and sometimes it results in incarceration.
So what kind of people then do you think are amenable to this, that it really works for them?
It really works for anyone who is motivated to change their behavior because of their addiction. Really, it's hard to narrow it down beyond that. The primary indicator is the willingness to conquer the addiction and begin recovery. If you have that, you have what it takes.
Mm. So does this
apply to all income strata? I mean, you see the variety. What kind of people are we looking at here?
Everything from soup to nuts. So we have people who are employed in law firms. We have people who are employed and successfully so in their own businesses. And then we have people who haven't worked in some time. So there is a life skill component for those that need to have the wraparound services of assistance with employment, with education. We make sure people are treated physically. So if they've been ignoring their physical health or their mental health, they're required to adhere to their doctor's protocols. It's a very holistic approach. And the individual in drug court agrees that they're going to be compliant with all those requirements.
Is there a difference in how they respond, whether it's high income, low income? What kind of response do you see?
It's possibly easier for people who come in already with employment because they're required to work a minimum of 25 to 35 hours a week, depending on their phase. So if you already have the advantage of a job and a car and a home, it's easier for you to meet the requirements of the program. But it may not be easier for you to maintain your sobriety and your be free from drug use. So the treatment is really the deciding factor.
Well, so if I'm a low-income person, I have some may even have a drug addiction or conviction on my record and so on. How do they meet in this job requirement?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Wicomico County Drug Court was a pilot program for the Made for Excellence program. We were granted a case manager who is still working with us to this day. And that person brings in the resources in the community to meet each individual's needs. But we can't overcome all challenges, and we still have some that are unmet. So we do our best. We work closely with HALO and Goodwill to provide jobs, community service, job readiness training. We partner with other agencies for other life skills, financial planning, and so forth to allow these people to rise up.
Hmm. So had you thought about this before this happened, before they initiated this program? I mean, as I mentioned a moment ago, that I guess it's been around. At least Florida, yeah. I think, was one of the mm-hmm. first back in 1989.
I'm a little chagrined to admit that I was a very traditional sentencing judge. So when I took the bench in 2000, I was all about punishment. And that gradually changed. I was a younger member of the bench and was very receptive to the new idea of drug court. So it was actually Donald C. Davis of our court, now retired, who asked me to begin drug court. And I didn't know that this was going to be a success. So I have I had some questions in my own mind about whether the judiciary belonged in this field, but I have since become a believer.
What kind of questions?
Well, you know, it's really typically an executive function for folks to receive treatment. That's what the health department does. That's what the Wicomico County Social Services does. Those kind of agencies are traditionally the ones charged with making sure people get to treatment and do what's necessary. Department of Parole and Probation, all executive branch. So to bring the judiciary in is a new notion. It's only 27 years old, and in the judiciary, that's new. So, but I have certainly seen the results, and they are very positive, and they're positive for our community because if someone can be safe and recovering in the community, we shouldn't be incarcerating them. It doesn't serve anyone's best interest. We have a huge level of oversight in our program, so we don't compromise public safety. Folks may be on GPS monitoring. They have home visits, which you would not normally have if you were on probation. There's a great deal of oversight to make sure that we address public safety, but also that we allow people to recover so that they don't reoffend.
Let me ask you this, because I grew up and during this great war on drugs. Mm-hmm. I may remember mandatory sentences, longer sentences. I've certainly saw that through the 1980s. Mm-hmm. Did we make a mistake?
Well, I don't believe that we knew what the results would be. So in retrospect, what you see is that if you incarcerate people while they're incarcerated, they are not offending in the community. But when they are released, they are not in a better place if they were primarily addiction motivated in their crimes. Our community has changed its approach, but I think that failing to recognize the need for treatment was essential for public safety was perhaps short-sighted on our part, yes.
Because one of the things that strikes me, particularly about jail, is it's not just simply you keep somebody away from the public for a given length of time, but the jail and prison itself is a process that it changes people when they go through it, mm-hmm. sometimes for better, but a lot of times for ill. And I'm just wondering whether or not, particularly for those people who, say, were picked up for, say, drug possession, mm-hmm. that it once they get into that system, they learn a whole new set of ways to relate to people which are not appropriate to the outside world.
Well, what I will tell you is that if you are motivated by addiction, you have to hit your rock bottom. And sometimes that requires that you experience what it is to be confined. And I'm really sad to say that, but it's absolutely true. So if we just, as you say, if we just refer people to treatment, if that were effective, we wouldn't need to have a public safety, consequence. But that's not what happens. And I'm afraid that sometimes that's what's necessary. Now, drug court is an idea to prevent that from happening. But even with drug court, you may have to experience incarceration in order to be reminded that this thing is going to take you down. And if you continue to reoffend, it's going to take your life.
How much of this, by the way, there is drug courts for both probation and also for post-incarceration? What's the policy for you guys?
We can do both. So some of the people that are in our drug court program came out of jail with a suspended sentence, but they serve some period of active incarceration. Others are able to come directly into drug court just on probation. So they may completely escape jail time, assuming that they are highly motivated to refrain from using drugs. Yes. Mm.
So what is it that when you look at somebody, what's going through your own mind? I mean, obviously you're considering all the little factors that go into what you're going to be doing, but does it affect you emotionally? Does it affect you personally?
Absolutely. It has totally changed my understanding of what addiction means to an individual, to their family, to our community. And the ripple effect of recovery is enormous, and it has completely changed my view about what my responsibility is as a circuit court judge, what my responsibility is as a member of this community. And I have embraced it. And, you know, there's great hope out there. And you're seeing the changes in our community. We have the COATS program. The detention center is becoming very proactive. We have the Vivitrol program that's starting.
And those programs are? Explain those for us.
Okay. So the COATS program is a first response program where people who are in overdose mode receive immediate intervention from people in the treatment community so that they can be connected with services like the 12-step programs, NAAA, other services that may allow them to not immediately overdose again. And this is was sponsored originally by the community. I believe that the state's attorney's office was the spearhead of this. And so Rich Bruckner is overseeing and spearheading that program. But that is to address the immediate consequences of an overdose before it's a question of whether or not charges are going to be filed. There may be cases where those charges will never be coming. You know, if there's no drugs or still on the premises, the individual is just really in need of help. So that's an early intervention. There's diversion programs offered by the state's attorney's office. At the jail, the Vivitrol program, Vivitrol is a drug that is a brand name of a drug, which is an inhibitor, so that the individuals who receive it, it's an injection, it's a roughly 30-day dosage, stop craving opiates. And that is a new program that the director, Cal Marakis, has brought to the detention center so that when an individual is released, if they are an opiate abuser, they can receive, at their request, a Vivitrol shot, which will allow them to go into the community without those cravings still being in place.
How significant is the difference between, on the one hand, someone may have a physical craving for a particular drug, as opposed to the psychological dependence that a lot of addicts, for instance, have, that they meet a tough situation and they'll slide back into this drug that made them feel better, that made them, at least on a temporary basis, allow them to cope with problems. And then eventually, obviously, then they kind of slip back into the use of drugs. I mean, how much of it is a psychological issue as opposed to, say, just simply a physical one?
Well, I would have to defer to my treatment experts on that. But what I will tell you is that what we see is that once you have exposed yourself to the drug, there is the immediate physical craving that has to be addressed. And that is a medical and a clinical issue, which I'm not really qualified to address.
Right.
From that point forward, we are, as a team, trying to prevent them from finding themselves in a situation where they will be stressed and relapse. So we treat that. We offer them stress management classes. They work very closely with their treatment provider. And you can see in the information that I've given you that they're in treatment for 15 months. At a minimum, because it's a 15-month program. That is extremely generous with treatment, much more generous than you would find in most non-drug court-related programs. And we've been very fortunate that our treatment community has been willing to work with us to extend treatment to that extent. Yes.
So when they deal with the stresses of life and they have this alternative out here, which they don't want to go back to, how does one deal with that? Does one just simply alleviate some of the roadblocks, for example, find them a job and that kind of thing? I mean, what kind of actions can one take to ensure that, A, that they continue on, obviously, for the period of time that you have, but then once they leave that program, mm-hmm. that they're not going to relapse because they don't have that kind of support that they did over that first initial period when you guys were supervising?
Mm-hmm. So the treatment goal is to connect them with people in recovery in the community so that they can surround themselves with a community that is knowledgeable about addiction. All these young people, and actually people of all ages, can embrace a lifestyle that's different. It is totally a lifestyle choice. And for 15 months to 2 years, we try to show them how to do that by connecting them with all of those resources in the community. And there are many, many.
How significant is family in all of this?
The ripple effect of recovery is enormous. We are very, very fortunate to observe people return to the custodial status of parenting. You know, many of them have not been able to be a parent. Many of our folks have been able to be caregivers to their parent when they weren't previously able to do that. They are able to pay child support. It is a beautiful thing to see a family recover. And that's what happens in recovery, is that the entire family gets the benefit of one person's recovery. And not only that is, you know, to the extent that it may be a genetic disease, the person in recovery is teaching the next generation that you too can recover. So I'd say it's an enormous ripple effect, and it's really a beautiful thing to see.
How does one deal with family members who might be skeptical? I mean, they've been through this a number of times, perhaps, seen mm-hmm. their loved one, with a family member or not, go through this cycle, and then, okay, now we're having this program, they're going through the courts and everything. But I can imagine as a family member, I might be just a little skeptical. How does one overcome that?
I think that you have to demonstrate the change. You know, it's not enough to say, I'm different now. You have to show it. And that's what they do. And so sometimes they have to do their initial recovery apart from their family until they can demonstrate that they can be trusted. So, yes, in addiction, they may have abused the trust of their family. They may have stolen from their family or created other chaos in the family. It is a process of redeveloping that trust. And that is what treatment is there to do, is to teach them and to how to do that and to also bring the family in to the treatment equation.
What kind of response do you get from law enforcement in a sense? I mean, not just some leadership, which obviously is clearly on board, but there are a lot of police and law enforcement say, you know, I'm really skeptical about this. This is the way we've been doing it for a long time. We clearly don't believe that drugs should be legalized, right? So this is the option. I mean, is there that sentiment out there?
Somewhat. I will tell you that it's changed over time, and that this recently in 2016, we have gone around to all of our partners in law enforcement, and we have revisited these same statistics that show drug court works, that the number of reoffenses is dramatically decreased. And, you know, law enforcement knows that they have to deal with people who are in active addiction again and again and again. They understand completely that if you can break the addiction, they're not likely to be seeing that person that way. So they understand it. It's a question of whether we can demonstrate that it works. And I have to tell you that over the time, if you are a law enforcement agent and you have to bring people back to life using Narcan, and then they go back out and they overdose again, you see the insanity of it, that it's not really just a question of someone being a bad person. This is something that is beyond just lock them up and solve the problem. So my belief is that the law enforcement community has absolutely begun to see that it is a better approach if we can also treat them. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't be consequences, and there are. So my experience has been that with the information that we provide to them, the level of oversight that we provide, which is very, very great, that they do support drug court. And we've been fortunate to have the support of the Sheriff's Department, Salisbury City Police Department, Fruitland Police Department, and they have representatives at every drug court hearing, at staffing. We listen to them. So they have an opportunity to say, we're alarmed. Please know that we have seen the following behavior. Please address it. And so there is that extra level of protection in drug court that you wouldn't have if somebody was on standard probation.
Let me ask you about something in relation to that. It may be one thing for somebody, for instance, who might get this treatment, say, without a conviction, without going through that process. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that has struck me, and we've discussed this a lot on this program, and that is that if you are convicted, if you have this conviction, that it becomes a serious impediment to getting on with your life, whether you've been involved in drugs or not. I mean, I've heard some horrendous cases where people, they can't get jobs. You know, it's the check the box kind of business. How significant is that conviction in terms of these people being able to get back onto their feet to get employed? Because a lot of employers will say two things. One is, if you've got a conviction, wait a minute, I'm not sure I want to hire you. But two, if you had a drug problem, I'm not sure I want to hire you either. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's that the societal prejudice, I guess, that exists there.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's definitely present. And what I will tell you is that the folks that come into drug court are not first offenders. If they were first offenders, they wouldn't be looking at the level of incarceration that promotes, you know, a willingness to take on this program. So we are not offering people traditionally probation before judgment to complete our program. Some of them, I believe, the state's attorney's office may give consideration to as in terms of what they'll plea them to if they're willing to take on drug court. So that may be a factor in the plea bargaining stage. But it is a hurdle to have a felony conviction. So if you end up with a felony conviction, our challenges at present are that you're not able to get funding for education if you want to pursue higher education. I was just talking to President Hoy at Warwick University Warwick College about how we can find opportunities for those people because it's a barrier for them to progress in their education, in their career. Those barriers that you described are absolutely there. Now, we have been fortunate to find employers who were willing to work with our folks. They know they're in drug court. They must know they're in drug court before we can work with an individual. But we believe in transparency. And as it turns out, that if you can demonstrate that you're no longer using drugs, you're being tested 3 or 4 times randomly in drug court. Observed urines. We can tell that employer they're clean, they're sober, they're going to be reliable. So to that extent, I believe that we've created a better situation for our folks than they might otherwise have. But I cannot say that we induce people into drug court by saving their criminal record, because by the time they get to us, that ship has sailed typically.
Right. I mean, and I'm sure you're familiar with, there was a book written a few years ago called The New Jim Crow, which focused on this kind of problem in terms of convictions and trying to to get ahead. Mm-hmm. And it just seems to me that you have a very specialized group, then that hopefully they can then move from whatever job that you might get them to another job down the road that mm-hmm. will accept them. But it seems to me that that is one of the highest hurdles. I mean, I've heard people say, well, okay, so they get out of jail, they get out of prison, and they get $25 or whatever it is, and they don't even get like a bus ticket. Right? I mean, is that kind of so? I mean, are we doing enough for people? I mean, and is this program maybe doing more than say we do for others?
This program is absolutely doing more than we do for others. Yeah. There's no question in my mind. And that's what makes it unique.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I thought we would be overrun with people who wanted to participate in drug court. we would just not be able to accommodate them all. And the fact of the matter is that because of the fact that they can't have any previous violent offenses, they can't have any handgun or sex offenses, they have to have a certain level of need for treatment. We really find that our capacity of 50 is more than enough to accommodate those people who qualify. So in terms of going forward, I think you'll see the Justice Reinvestment Act is addressing some of the concerns that you express. And as the community continues to struggle with what will we achieve through conviction and incarceration versus what can we achieve through other alternatives, you may continue to see a shift. What I will also say is that, you know, if you commit a crime, there is a victim. And there is restitution, there is rehabilitation, there is, you know, retribution. And all of those are sentencing functions. And so, while, yes, we as a community, I think, need to offer more to our offenders to reintegrate them into the community, I don't think we can ignore that there have been some people who are injured and who are entitled to have that taken into account.
By the way, I was going to mention, with this group that you deal with, what kind of racial composition are we looking at? Do you have any sense about that at all?
I don't have any statistics about that, but what I will tell you is this. When we started this program in 2005, the drug of choice was cocaine, crack cocaine. And so at that time, I'd say that we had a more racially mixed population than we have now. I would just estimate, and I'm sorry, I can't give you the exact figures, that probably 70% of our population at this point are Caucasian. And I believe that is a factor of the change in the drug usage of the individuals. But it also is a factor of the legal screening that takes into account prior records and the types of prior offenses that will be deemed as ineligible. And that's a federal law that makes that requirement. So when the federal government wants to change that, it may have some equalizing effect.
Because what strikes me as I'm listening to you that, if you're in a minority community, it's quite likely that you, if you committed some kind of crime that you, and we've seen the statistics that in which African Americans are more than likely to be arrested, that kind of thing. You're aware of those stats. That may create some kind of barrier that's not really seen. You know that you get a lot of white offenders who maybe have gotten addicted to say something because they had a prescription drug, for example, or something like that. Whereas opposed to the experience of somebody in another community, that's not the case. There might be like there's sort of an invisible barrier that we're not really taking into account. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand that the reasons for why you have the rules that you do in terms of other things, crimes and so on. But it does seem as if there might be something invisible there. I mean, I don't know if you thought about that or not.
Well, going back to when I was a master and I handled a lot of juvenile cases, we went through the state and we went to juvenile facilities to see what they offered. And you could see that the population of the individuals in commitment was primarily African American. And so that generated a lot of questions. And the same questions are generated today with the adult population. And that is in areas which may be economically disadvantaged, there is more crime, which results in more law enforcement, which results in more arrest, which results in more convictions, which results in, more sentences. And it's very difficult for me to say as a sitting circuit court judge why it is that when we get to the point that we're at, we don't see a more equal distribution of the races. But what I can say is that, you know, it starts at the first level. And so it probably goes back as far as economic opportunities and educational opportunities and things of that nature. And yeah, that's the best I can tell you.
Okay, one final question, the hardest of all, which is, we've had a tremendous amount of discussion about opioid addiction. Lots of efforts to get treatment and so on and so forth. Moving away from the idea that maybe law enforcement is quite the right way to do, whether it's prison, that kind of thing. We've seen this, and we've seen discussions about prison reform, certainly on the federal and also on the state level. And one of the things that strikes me, particularly about the drug issue, is that, you know, in the 1980s and so on, drug addiction and so on and that sort of thing seemed to be confined, at least in public mind, to inner cities, other people. Now it's affecting suburbs. I mentioned, for instance, Maine, where predominantly white community, and yet they're really having a tough time with heroin addiction. Is our softening, do you think, towards drug crimes or possession of drugs, that kind of thing, do you think that's related to the fact that the white community is now becoming affected by this problem, and that maybe we took a law and order approach when we thought it didn't?
Well, that would have to assume that we're ignoring the lessons of the past. You know, if you had a crystal ball, you'd be able to know now what the experience of 25 years in the future will tell you. So I can't really say one way or the other. What I can say is that people with resources can have their voices heard. And I think you see with the legislature, they're hearing the voices that are being heard about the need for recovery and a need to shift from corrections. But they also are armed with the statistics that show that over time, this has not been effective to deal with abuse-driven offenses. So that's the best I can tell you.
Well, that's okay. We've been speaking with Kathleen Beckstedt. She's an associate judge for the Wicomico County Circuit Court, and we appreciate you stopping by and talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Steve Martin, the host of Unreal Bluegrass. Each week we'll bring you a wide range of bluegrass, from the innovative artists of today to the traditional pickers from yesteryear. All this and interviews with players from all walks of life. That's 3 hours of Unreal Bluegrass every Sunday at 7 p.m. on WSDL 90.7 FM, Rhythm and News.
Have you ever heard an idea that changed the way you look at the world?
Everything we think,
we've had to believe.